Okay, well, in our continuing series of pedagogical talks on quantum information, we're happy to have Bill Wooters from Williams College, who will speak on quantifying entanglement.
Right. And thanks very much. I was told this was supposed to be a pedagogical talk for people who are not experts in quantum information theory, and I designed it that way. So if you're in that category, feel free to slow me down as I speak. If I'm saying stuff that's not clear, make me make it clear. And the people who know it already will just have to put up with that. Okay. Can everyone see it, or should some lights be turned off? So entanglement is really at the core of quantum information, I think. Almost any talk you hear on quantum information will probably have entanglement in there somewhere. And a number of people have looked into trying to understand entanglement in its own right. And that's what this is about, especially how do you say how much entanglement you have. Well, first of all, what is entanglement? It's a special kind of correlation that's unique to quantum mechanics. There's no classical analog of it. And let me just dive right in. Here's the outline to the talk. So there are four sections. First, an introduction. Then I'll talk about quantifying entanglement in two different ways, the operational approach and the axiomatic approach, and then we end with some interesting facts. And I will alert you when the sections change so you'll know where we are in the talk. And by the way, in case you get worried because we're still in this and a lot of time has passed, these last two are quite short. So if a minute is left right here, I can still finish the talk, I think. And also, don't be bothered by I think there are some other interesting facts in here as well. They're not all confined to the last half minute. I hope, especially if you haven't seen this before, I think there are quite a few interesting facts. So here's part one, introduction to entanglement. I want to talk about qubits. Qubit is a two-state quantum system, like the electron spin, okay, two orthogonal states, or photon polarization, or a hypothetical two-level atom. Okay, those are all qubits, quantum bits. And a pure state of a qubit, say an electron spin, is easy to describe. You can have up or down or any linear combination of those with complex alpha and beta, and represent it as just a direction in space. In the case of electron spin, it really does correspond to a direction in space. In the case of photon polarization, it corresponds to a direction in the same kind of sphere, but it's not interpreted as space anymore. So that's a single qubit. What if you have two electrons, say? What's the most general pure state, a pure quantum state of two electron spins? And if this were anything like classical physics, the answer would be this. You have, you just say the state of one and the state of the other, and that would be the end of it. So you have, here's this state. Is that as focused as it can possibly be? And the state of the other, and then you can multiply these out and get a state of the pair that would look like this, where I've said alpha times gamma is that, and so on. But the remarkable thing is that this is not the most general possible pure state of two electron spins. The most general is an arbitrary combination of these four basis states. Up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And you can see that this is more general than this, because if it's this, then certainly that number times this number is the same as this number times that number, right? Because multiplication is commutative, whereas AD doesn't have to be the same as BC. And in fact, it's not hard to show that that you can break a state like this up into a product form like this if and only if AD is not the same. I mean, AD is equal to BC. If it's not, then you can't break it up. We say the state is inseparable or entangled, and neither particle has a spin direction of its own in that case. Okay, neither one has a pure state of its own. The pair together has a pure state, but not each one individually. That's entanglement in the simplest possible manifestation. And here are a couple of examples of entangled states. The most famous entangled state in the world is probably that top one there. It's the singlet state of two spin 1/2 particles, up, down, minus, down, up. And it has this interesting property that if you measure the spin in any direction, as long as you make the same measurement on both particles, you always get an anti-correlation. So vertically, horizontally, it doesn't matter. You always get the opposite results. Whereas, and here's another entangled state, which looks very similar. And if you were thinking classically, you would say that's about the same thing as that. The only difference is the sign. But it's really quite a different state. It's not the singlet state. It's one of the triplet states. And it's true you still have the opposite anti-correlation if you measure vertically. But if you measure horizontally, you get a positive correlation. Okay, they do the same thing. In fact, this state is orthogonal to that one, which means they can be distinguished from each other. And it's very easy to distinguish them. You just test. You can make this measurement here. If you get the same, then it's this one. If it's opposite, you get that. It was that one. Also, you can transform the singlet state, the top state, into this lower state just by rotating one of the particles by 180 degrees around the vertical axis. And that's going to come up later. Okay, so those are some examples of entangled states. How do you make a separated entangled pair? A non-separated entangled pair is very easy to make. The two electrons in a helium atom in the ground state are pretty much in that singlet state, pretty close. That's entangled. It happens all the time. Well, no one had to work to make that happen. But if you want to make particles entangled but be far away from each other, it's a little harder. And also, that's more interesting because you can do interesting things with it. Here are some examples of how to do it. To make entangled photons, you take a pulse of light, shine it through a special nonlinear crystal, and most of the photons will go straight through, but some of them will break up into smaller photons, each having half the energy of the original. And if you orient the crystal right and choose the directions right that you're picking out of the outgoing photons, you can make the polarizations of these two photons entangled with each other. And with atoms, you can get them to be entangled. Here are two Rydberg atoms. This is a cavity, a microwave cavity. And this one is in one level higher than that one. We call this one excited and call this one ground. The excited one will go through this cavity. It may or may not release a photon to leave in the cavity. And if it does, the experiment is arranged so that the second atom will definitely pick up that energy if it's there in the cavity, leaving the cavity empty. It was empty. I should say this is cold, about 1K, and there weren't any photons to speak of the right frequency to begin with. So this thing will pick it up. And so by the time both atoms have passed through, you don't know where that extra energy is. It could be in the first or the second atom. And in fact, it's a coherent superposition of the two. You can make it that way. And that means that the two are really entangled. Here's another example, kind of a trivial example of an entangled state. Suppose you want to make two light beams entangled with each other. That can be done. If you just send a single photon to a beam splitter, then the photon go this way or this way, and those are coherently superposed. If you want to think of these paths or these modes of the electromagnetic field as your quantum systems, then these two are entangled with each other because you have a superposition of one photon here and zero photons here, coherently superposed with one photon here and zero photons there. So that's another example of entanglement of two physical systems. They can be far apart. Let me also just distinguish entanglement from mere correlation. Okay, this singlet state up, down, minus, down, up, which will be sort of my standard entangled state here in this talk, is quite different from having the systems either are this or that, and we don't know which. If it were the latter case, then there would be no horizontal correlations. There would be the vertical anti-correlation, but nothing horizontally. It would be completely independent. So what's sort of special about these pure entangled states is, you know, whatever measurement you make on one, you can find some other measurement to make on the other where you have this perfect correlation. Let me just give a brief history of thinking about entanglement. So 1926, here's a timeline. Quantum mechanics comes into being with all of the entanglement implicit in it. In 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen used entanglement in quantum mechanics to argue that the theory is incomplete. It's a beautiful argument. Nothing wrong with the argument, but Bell later showed that if their argument were correct, actually quantum mechanics wouldn't just be incomplete, it would be wrong. It turned out that quantum mechanics has survived that test. Also in 1935, Schrodinger wrote a paper, was inspired by that paper, in which he said entanglement is the feature of quantum mechanics that makes it unique, makes it different, that forces a departure from classical ways of thinking. And Bell's theorem, which was really quite interesting, led to much discussion about the meaning of entanglement. What's non-separability? What is it saying about the world? Or does information go faster than light? What's going on? All that's very interesting stuff, but not what I'm talking about. In the 1990s, people started saying entanglement is really interesting, but it's also useful. You can use it to do these communication tasks that can't be done without it. It's used in quantum computing, or it will be, and quantum cryptography. There are quantum cryptography schemes that are based on entanglement. And here's one such use, which I'll refer to later also, teleportation. And it goes like this. The problem is you have two people, Alice and Bob, and Alice is given some state. Let's suppose the state phi is a state of a spin 1/2 particle, okay, pointing in some direction. It's a pure state. She wants to get that state to Bob, okay? And the problem is she doesn't know where Bob is, okay, because he's some sort of secret agent, and he can't reveal his location. And also, she doesn't know what phi is. This was given, the state was given to her by someone else. She has to get it to Bob. Okay. And it's very hard to imagine how to do that. She can't make just lots of copies of phi because you can't copy quantum states. If she could, she could send them all out to all the places that Bob might be. He could pick it up. Teleportation is designed to address this question, to answer it. And here's how it works. Alice and Bob, knowing that this is going to happen, long time ago, back when they were at the same place maybe, and she knew, or at least where she, when she knew where he was, they prepared this singlet state, which they share between them. So the first particle, this one, which is the same as this one, will go to Alice, and the second one, which is this one, will go to Bob. They can just hang on to those particles for as long as they like, or as long as they can. In this ideal world, they just keep them in a suitcase, a special suitcase, that prevents it from decohering. And so then later, when Bob is somewhere else, Alice doesn't know where he is, someone hands Alice this state that is to be transferred to Bob. She can't just measure it. That would mess it up. But what she can do is perform a joint measurement on her half of this entangled pair and this state phi. The joint measurement is a measurement whose eigenstates are these four. So she's asking the two particles, which of these four states are they in? Of course, they're not in any of those four states. They've never seen each other before, and these are all four entangled states. But they are orthogonal states. We already saw that these two are orthogonal, and here's some others. And so she makes this measurement, which is a hard measurement to do in practice, but nothing wrong with it in principle. Which of the four states are the two particles are they in? And if you go through the algebra, you find that if for example, the two particles say they're in this state, okay, the measurement forces them to be in one of these four states. If they choose this state, then the algebra says that from that moment on, you may regard Bob's particle that he's been carrying all this time as having the state phi. Okay, it is in the state phi. And if Alice gets one of these other options, if you haven't seen this before, it's really amazing. If you have seen it before, it's less amazing. But still sort of amazing. If she gets one of these other answers, then Bob's particle is not phi, but it's phi simply rotated by 180 degrees around the z-axis in this case, okay, or around the x or y-axis in these cases, always 180 degrees. So the Bob can, once he finds out, this is the classical signal, Alice has to tell Bob which of the four outcomes she got, okay, so it's just one of four possibilities. Once Bob finds out, then he performs the corrective rotation, and he ends up with phi, with the correct state. So this is using entanglement to do a communication task that you really can't do without it. And I always love to ask the question, how did the information get from here to here? How did this state get from here to here? Did it go by way of the classical signal? No, it did not, because the classical signal turns out completely uncorrelated with the state phi. Okay? That is, which of these four outcomes occurs, and that's what the classical signal is telling Bob which of these four outcomes occurred. That has nothing to do with the state phi. These happen at random. It's one out of four chance of any of them happening, regardless of what the state phi is. So there's no information about phi in this signal. What's kind of neat is if there's an eavesdropper, eavesdropper won't find anything out about phi by looking at this signal. And so you might say that information went this way, which has its own problems. Okay. So I'll just leave you with the question. I'm not going to answer that question. Yes?
Question. Yeah. Since the particle that Alice has is not entangled with phi, she's not going to get one of those.
Isn't that a good question? It's a very good question. It's a very good question. She's in some linear combination. These two particles are in some linear combination of these. That's absolutely right. In fact, it's an equally weighted linear combination of all four. When she makes the measurement, it forces one of those things to happen, which, you know, in a standard way of thinking, it forces Bob's particle to be in the corresponding state. You have to chew on that for a while. It's a funny thing. But it's a useful thing, or could be useful. So there's a use for entanglement in communication. Now, so far, all the entangled states I've talked about are pure states, okay? But most of the work that's been done on quantifying entanglement, telling how much entanglement you have, the hard stuff is on mixed states. So let me address the question of mixed states. When is a mixed state entangled? And here's an example. Suppose that Alice and Bob, they may not look the same as in the previous transparency, they are the same people. In all these, they're always the same people, and they might look different every time. Start out with this singlet state shared between them. And suppose that Bob has this little device that his particle goes through that with probability 50% rotates the spin by 180 degrees around the z-axis. And with probably one half, it leaves it alone. This is a very crude model of noise. Okay, so there's some noise at Bob's end that does this. Okay, he has no idea which is going to happen, and he can't find out. Okay, the machine blows up after it does this. And so at the end, they've got this pair. Alice and Bob have this pair, which is a 50-50 mixture, just a probabilistic mixture, not quantum superposition, just a mixture of this state and this state, which is what happens when you rotate it by 180 degrees around the z-axis. Let's call this state psi minus, which is standard notation for this, and call this state psi plus. Then what Alice and Bob have now is a mixture of those two entangled states. Now, they're both entangled, but they don't know which one they have. And the question is, what they have, is that entangled? Okay, the mixed state, rho represents a density matrix here. Does that represent an entangled state? We can't answer that question unless we say what we mean by entanglement of mixed state. In fact, the question is designed to make me say what one means by entanglement of a mixed state. And the answer that we come up with is that no, this state is not entangled, because the density matrix that's a mixture of the singlet state and this triplet state can also be written, mathematically it's identical to a 50-50 mixture of this state up-down and the state down-up. Okay, it's the very same density matrix, which means there's no physical test you can do that would distinguish between this case and this case. It's physically the same. So, and what is this? This just means that, well, they might have up-down or they might have down-up and they don't know which it is. And we already said that doesn't count as entanglement. That's just correlation. That's not entanglement. And so how do we make this precise? We say, when we say that a state is entangled, it means that Alice and Bob can't just create it from scratch over the phone. This one they could create from scratch over the phone as follows. This large object that Alice is holding is a coin that she's going to toss. Okay, is it heads or tails? If it's heads, that she makes an upstate and she informs Bob to make the downstate. If it's tails, they make this state. So with a coin and a phone, they can make this combination. Oh, and then they have to forget which one they made in order for it to be legitimately this mixed state. Okay. When you create a mixed state, there's always some throwing away of information. Okay? Well, the fact is they can create it over a phone, so therefore, we want to say that kind of thing is exactly what we mean by not entangled. And if they can't create it from scratch over the phone, we say it's entangled. And I could put that in mathematical terms. We could say if the density matrix can be written as a mixture of product states, okay, as this one can be, then it's not entangled, even if you can also write it as a mixture of entangled states. Okay? And let me introduce this phrase here. Local operations in classical communication is used all the time in this research on entanglement, on quantifying entanglement. That basically means what Alice and Bob are doing here. They can do local operations. They can make states up and down. They can rotate states locally, do anything they want, make measurements locally on Alice's side, or Bob can make his on his side. And they can talk to each other over the phone, but they can't, if they're restricted to local operations in classical communication, they cannot send quantum particles one to the other. They can't send a photon from one to the other in which the polarization is important, say, or some coherent property of it is important. Okay, and that idea is is the basis of almost all the work that's been done on quantifying entanglement. So now we move into part two of the talk, quantifying entanglement. So that was the end of the introduction, and we're at part two. And it's all based on this idea of Alice and Bob doing things that they can do over the phone. LOCC means over the phone. And here's one thing they can do, which is really quite interesting. If Alice and Bob share a whole bunch of copies of some state phi, it's a pure state in this transparency. This is just pure states. It's a pure state. For example, it might be like the singlet state, but maybe there's more of the up-down than there is of the down-up. Okay? Now that's an interesting question. If there's more up-down than down-up, is that as entangled as the singlet state, or is it less entangled, or what? And this answers that question. So you've got some state here. They have multiple copies of it. It's a fact, or interesting fact, that just by doing local things over here, local things over there, and talking to each other over the phone, they can convert these guys, in principle, into some other number of perfect singlet states, okay, with balanced up, down, and down, up. I think I'll not say now how they do that, but if you ask, I will say more about that. So, but it's just local things, local operations, and classical communication. And moreover, you can do this. I am speaking asymptotically here. We really have a large number of these and a large number of these. And asymptotically, you can also go backwards, okay? And the ratio of number of these perfect singlets to the number of these other states is independent of whether you're going this way or this way, okay? If five of these make three of these, then three of these make five of these. It's really, really nice. Which means that it's a very natural way to define entanglement for pure states, the quantity of entanglement. You just define one of these guys as our standard state, have one unit of entanglement, which we call one e-bit, okay? So one e-bit of entanglement. And then you figure out how much entanglement you have here just by how many of these are equivalent to how many of these. If five are equivalent to three, then these things must have 3/5 e-bit of entanglement each, okay? So altogether, this would have 3 e-bits of entanglement, which would match this 3 e-bits. Okay, it's beautiful that one can do that. And so that's how we define the entanglement of a pure state. It's a pretty natural, kind of uniquely specified definition. Of course, it's one thing to pose the question. Okay, that's the definition of the thing. It's another thing to find out what is that ratio for a particular state. right? And that's been done, completely done. So for any state, it doesn't have to be a qubit, it could be any dimensional quantum system. Any bipartite pure state can always be written in this form. This is called the Schmidt decomposition, where this is an orthonormal basis for Alice's half and an orthonormal basis here for Bob's half. And these are complex numbers, or we can actually make them real positive numbers, real non-negative numbers. Make them real, yeah, anyway. And so if you write it in that form, the entanglement, by this definition, turns out to be, this was proved by Bennett and others in 1996, the entropy of the squares of these guys. This is the entropy, the Shannon entropy, is that formula. So, for example, if it's this case, the gammas would be just alpha and beta. So, and this entropy is a function that is maximized when these coefficients are equal in magnitude, and it goes to zero at the extreme. So if it's all up down, that's zero entanglement. If it's all down up, that's zero entanglement. The maximum is where there are equal amounts of both. Okay, so that's a completely solved problem, the entanglement of pure states. And so that means that all the work that's been done lately on this kind of question has been with mixed states. And here's how it looks for mixed states. And it's complicated in just one way that turns out to be hard to deal with. So here, it's a very similar idea, though. How do you quantify entanglement for mixed states? So here's the mixed state that you're talking about. Okay, it might be a mixture of psi plus and psi minus, these two entangled states that I talked about before. It could be any other mixture of states. Some noisy pair of states shared between Alice and Bob, and it's got some noise in it. We have to deal with this question because in real life you have noise all the time. So what do we mean by entanglement? Well, once again, you can start with standard pure states, singlet states, and try to create many copies of this mixed state out of it. Okay. And also, as in the previous slide, you could start with some of these guys and try to create pure singlets out of that. Okay. So this is called the creation of the state rho, and this is called distillation. Okay. You distill from this noisy entanglement pure entanglement. But now there's the possibility that it might take more of these pure singlets to create rho than you can get out when you distill. Again, all these processes are just over the phone kind of processes. One way to see why that might happen is in creating a rho, you have to destroy some information. You have to throw away information to create a mixed state out of pure states. So you're throwing something away. So it's maybe not surprising that you end up with less than what you started. So now we actually have two notions, whereas for pure states there's just one measure of entanglement. For these mixed states we have two. This entanglement cost, so the cost to create the thing, is n over m, where this is n, this is m. And this thing called distillable entanglement is that divided by that number, n prime divided by m, how much you can get out. Again, this is all asymptotic, okay, for large n, okay. So these are all, when I write this, I really mean the limit as n goes, it gets very large. Okay. I like to dwell on this one because the next transparency is kind of ugly. Because I'm going to say a little bit about how you do this distillation. Okay. Sorry?
D is always less than E.
So D, you would think, is always less than E. That's not true. Sometimes it's equal. Okay. In fact, it was only this year that someone was able to prove definitively that there's a density, a state, for which D is less than E, strictly less than E. Isn't that remarkable? It's because this asymptotic business is hard to deal with sometimes. E cannot be bigger than D. D cannot be bigger than E, sorry, right. So E is entanglement cost. Sometimes people write it as E sub C. I'm just using E. Okay, let me talk about this distillation process. How do you distill from... Oh, sorry? Is there a formula for D? Oh, wouldn't that be great? That'd be great if there were a formula for D. If there were a formula for D, I would give you $5 for it. Okay. No, I'd give you more. Sorry?
I'll
offer 50.
50?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And do I hear, no, really, I think you could get a lot for it if you said you had a formula and people believed you. No, there's no formula. I will show you in a minute what we know about D. Well, a large hunk of what we know about D. You might ask, is there a formula for E also? Right, you could ask that. And I would give you $100 for that too. So.
What?
What's your definition of formula? A formula for E? It means some analytic function, you stick rho, okay. You're given some.
Without having to take any
premodal. Right. You just plug it in and it spits out something, yeah. We don't have formulas for either of those. But let me say something about how you do this distillation. How do you distill pure entanglement from noisy entanglement? Okay, let's suppose that you've got a mixture of these two states I've been talking about all along. It's a mixture of this and this, but it's not a 50-50 mixture. If it were, we already know that's not entangled. We talked about that case already. But suppose you've got more of the singlet than you've got of this state. Okay, so you have these two pairs with more singlet. Each one has, why do I say two? I mean, we assume that Alice and Bob have a large number of these pairs. I'm just going to talk about two of them. Okay, and each of these pairs is in this state rho, this mixed state, which is a mixture of the two. If you want, you can think of these two pairs as having encompassing four possibilities. They could both be in this state, or you could have one in this and one in this, or one in this and one in this, or both be in that state. Okay. Anyway. So there they have it. And the system works better if you have more, but I'm just going to show you can do some distillation with just two. You can begin to distill with just two. So again, they're confined to local operations. And here's what they do in classical communication. Here's what they do. And it's certainly not important to memorize the details of this. The important thing is that there's something that they can do locally. So the first thing, Alice flips the spin of number, this is the number one pair, if number two pair is up. And I should say, there's no measurement involved in this step here. Okay, it's a quantum gate that's acting, it's a unitary transformation that she applies to these two. Okay, and same thing, Bob does a similar thing over at his end. Actually, not the same thing, but a similar thing in this particular scenario. Okay. What's important about that is these operations have the effect of interchanging psi plus and psi minus on pair number two if pair number one was in the psi minus state, and leaving everything unchanged if number one was in the psi plus state. Then Alice and Bob measure their second pair. Okay. And they ask, is that second pair psi plus or psi minus? Okay, that's the measurement they make. Okay, how can they do that? They can just do the measurement we talked about on the second transparency, which is measuring the horizontal in a horizontal direction, see if you have correlation or positive or negative correlation. So they can do that. That requires some communication. That's where the phone comes in. Okay, to decide which they have. And if they get psi minus, if number two is psi minus, they throw the whole thing away. They throw both pairs away. If number two is psi plus, then they hold on to number one, which they haven't measured. Okay, and I claim it's going to be purer than the one they started, than what they started with. You can see it in this way. How could number two have been psi plus? Well, two ways. Either both were originally psi plus, in which case this one didn't change that one, or both were originally psi minus, in which case this one changed this one to a psi plus. Those are the only two ways that can happen. They happen with probabilities proportional to p squared and q squared. So therefore, their resulting state has got these probabilities proportional to p squared and q squared. I've just normalized them. And you can check that this coefficient here is bigger than p. So you've got more singlet than you had before. Okay, before you had more singlet than the other kind, but now you have even more, so it's closer to being pure singlet. But you've lost one of your pairs, and some of the time you've lost both of your pairs. So you keep repeating this, you will eventually get arbitrarily close to a singlet, but you will have lost some pairs. Okay, now there, you can do much better if you have more pairs to work with from the beginning than just two. And for this particular state, this combination of psi plus and psi minus, we know D. We have a formula for D. Okay, so I want to jump up and down about that. Okay, so for this one case, here is the formula. You were asking for a formula. Here it is in this case, just a function of P. And notice it's you get here's 100% distillable right here. This would be, if you actually start out with psi minus, you're already there, so you don't lose anything. If your P is a half, we've already seen this case. It's an equal mixture of psi plus and psi minus. That's unentangled. You can't distill anything out of it. But any other mixture, you can get something out. Okay?
Q is 1 minus P.
I'm sorry. Where Q is 1 minus P. Right. Thanks. Okay, so this was figured out by Eric Raines a couple of years ago. And off the top of my head, I don't know of any other case where we have a formula for D. Okay, this is it. There may be some that I'm just not thinking of. You need a strategy, and you need to prove it's the best strategy. That's the hard part. We actually had this strategy some years ago, 1996, but it took a few years to prove that it was the best strategy for this comp.
Should we take a general?
Sorry?
Should we take a general density matrix as your strategy?
Can you, do you have a strategy for general density matrix? Sorry?
What's there are strategies.
There are strategies, but nothing that one would claim is optimal necessarily, right?
But there are strategies that necessarily.
But there are strategies that can distill. That's right. And so a whole other question is just a binary question. Is this density matrix distillable or not? Which is a whole other area of investigation. Just dividing density matrices into two classes. In general, there will be many strategies, right? Sure, right. Some better than others, but maybe a number that are effective. What good is distillation? If you have distillation, you can do this. This is a neat thing. So what is entanglement distillation good for? It's good for sending a quantum state over a noisy channel. Suppose you have a quantum state here. I'll just quickly say how you do this. You have a quantum state. Here you have some nice, pure, entangled singlets, say, that you've prepared. This is a funny notation here, but bear with me. Okay, I just didn't want to draw arrows all over the place. This is supposed to be a singlet. So you have a bunch of singlets here that Alice prepares. Alice is trying to send this state to Bob. That's all she's trying to do. This is all auxiliary to that. And then she sends one half of each of these guys through the noisy channel, where it gets corrupted. Okay, so now you have some corrupted density matrix type pairs. Okay, these are mixed states. And now she and Bob together distill these guys down to a smaller number of pure singlets. Okay? And once they have that, now she can teleport this guy right over to Bob with no error whatsoever, okay, because it's a pure singlet. This is some people, I think the Horodetskys, have called this counterfactual error correction, where you correct the errors before you even know what you're trying to send. So it's kind of a neat thing. Also, now you could say you can also do this alternatively by invoking a quantum error correction code, where you somehow encode this state into more qubits and send them through, and then try to recover the state at the other end. But this is actually demonstrably better in some cases than that. You have the advantage here in the distillation process of two-way communication between Alice and Bob. It actually makes it better. You can actually get more information through per qubit that you send, more quantum information per sent qubit by this technique.
Is that asymptotically?
Sorry, asymptotically.
When you're allowed to make very, very long strings for sending your quantum.
Yes, yes, right. Isn't that nice? So it is nice. No. So this two-way distillation actually can beat regular quantum error correction. So that.
For a fixed number of qubits, I believe that, but.
No, it's true asymptotically. Yeah.
So you can do better than the optimal capacity of distillation.
Yeah, you can. Right.
It's even the case that there are quantum channels that have zero capacity, but which still permit conveyance of quantum information by this.
Oh, that is true. Right. A simple depolarizing channel with enough depolarizing will do the trick. Right. Okay. So that's distillation. What about this entanglement cost, the cost of entanglement? Let me just mention, is this a 50-minute talk? It's an hour talk, good. An upper bound on entanglement cost. So we don't have a formula for entanglement cost either. Even worse, really. We know less about entanglement cost than we do about distillable entanglement. Entanglement cost. How can we get a handle on what it costs to make an entangled pair? So this is the other end of the picture. Well, here's one way to make lots of copies of a density matrix. You write the density matrix as a mixture of pure states. Okay. In fact, there are lots of ways to write a density matrix as a mixture of pure states. These don't have to be orthogonal states. Okay. Lots of ways of doing that. Okay. And then what you do is you just create these guys. Okay. Now that may, if these are entangled, that might take some prior entanglement in the form of singlets to do that. Okay. In other words, the idea is you write rho as a mixture of pure states. We know how hard it is to create a pure state. We know exactly, we have a formula for that. How hard is it, how many singlets does it take to create a given pure state? So this we know. And then you just take the average of those guys, and that's how hard it is to make rho in this way. Because what you're doing is you make lots of copies of all these things. And then, in order to make it a mixed state, not a pure state, you forget which one is which. You know, you have to throw out that information in order to make it a mixed state. And so that leads to this potential formula for entanglement cost, which is you consider all the possible ways of writing rho as a mixture of pure states. For each of those ways, we know what the entanglement cost for the pure state is. We average that up, okay, and we take the minimum over all the different ways that you can write rho as a mixture of pure states. Okay, and that thing there is called, for historical reasons, the entanglement of formation of rho. When it was introduced, it was thought to be the entanglement cost by me and others, who, right? And it turned out, no, it might not be. It might not be equal to the entanglement cost because you can consider the following. Suppose you have two copies of rho. You have a rho and another rho here. And you ask, how can you break that whole thing up into pure states? Okay, pure states of a larger system now. And then how much does it cost to make those pure states? It might be cheaper to do it that way than to think about just one copy.
Is there an example known?
No, there's no example known. It's only a possibility. It's one of the most frustrating things in this whole business, that we do not know whether entanglement of formation is additive. Okay, if you have two copies, couldn't that be better, cheaper than one? Okay, we have no example. And some cases where it's known that it is additive, but not general. So it could be, if this thing, if that's not, or turns out not to be a problem, then EF is equal to E. It is the entanglement cost. That would be a very good thing because we have formulas in many cases for E, F, for E sub F. So if we can show that it's the same as E, we're in really good shape. Okay. One thing that has been shown only this year is, oh no, only last year, excuse me, last year, is that at least this limit is E. The limit, if you take a whole bunch of copies of rho, okay, and then do this decomposition business and find the entanglement of formation, and find the per copy entanglement of formation, that limit is the entanglement cost. That had to be proved, and that was proved last year. So at least we have that. I'm still thinking that these things are equal. I really want that to be the case, because otherwise it gets too hairy. Okay, and now let me just show you something that we know about it, just to finish this picture that I showed earlier. I showed this. Yes, Michael.
I was about to ask, I know a lot of numerical work has been done on that question.
Yeah.
Can you give us an update on what you know?
Well, I don't know what's been done lately. I know John Smolin worked out some examples and found looking for counterexamples and wasn't able to find any. I and a student did some of that work too. It's not published because it wasn't very interesting. We didn't find any counterexamples, and we thought we had a good place to look for counterexamples. Didn't find them there. So And then there are a few cases where it's been shown that, that there's... Oh, well, that's a different kind of additivity. Sorry. Okay. Right. Okay. So, anyway, but entanglement of formation, we do know a formula, and on the same scale, on the same graph, it looks like this. For this particular combination, a mixture of these two states, entanglement formation, you can see, is bigger than D. And if it's true that the entanglement cost is bigger than D, then there would be an example where there's a difference. That's right. This is where the D, where that thing comes in. It's the same example. Okay. And that ends part two. And none too soon. So now we get to part three. A different, completely different approach. So that all of that approach to quantifying entanglement was based on sort of usefulness. Okay, how much does it cost to make this, and how much distillable useful entanglement can be gotten out of it? Oh yes.
So far, this has all been just for two.
Oh yes, just two parts. That's true. And I have a final page where I show all the things I haven't talked about, and more than two is one of those things I'm not talking about. Yeah, because there's so much. It's a big. It's become a really large field. I mean, a lot of work has been done in the last few years. A completely different approach to, not completely, but a different approach to quantifying entanglement is the axiomatic approach. Not what's useful, but just choose some axioms, which you can also do, you know, for Shannon's information. You can do a useful approach to Shannon information, or you can do an axiomatic approach. Here's an axiomatic approach to entanglement. Here are four axioms that one might insist on for any measure of entanglement of a two-part system. We might require that it satisfy, so F is going to be some measure of entanglement, require that it be monotonic in the sense that it does not increase on average under local operations in classical communication. You can't generate entanglement over the phone. Okay, let's insist on that. Let's insist on continuity. Okay, just that rho is a continuous function of, I mean, F is a continuous function of rho. Actually, that gets into, some, one can say that very technically, and I won't. I'll just leave it at that. Additivity. In that if you have many copies, it's just, the entanglement is n times what you have for one copy. And this kind of convexity, if you have a mixture of pure states, then the entanglement of the mixture is no larger than the average entanglement of the pure states. Okay, that's also a plausible thing. If you insist only on those assumptions, then you can prove, the Horodetskys have proven, Horodetskys are a family of physicists, a father and two sons, who have done a lot of work on the subject, a lot of great work. And one thing they did was to show that any such F lies between D and E, okay, including D and E. So actually, there's about D, I'm not sure we know that it satisfies continuity, right? Right. So, but maybe it does. But any. Sorry?
It's unasymptotic. Because things really continuous if you have.
That's the problem. Because it's defined asymptotically. Right. But any F that satisfies those axioms has to be between D and E. So this is actually reassuring. It means there's something still special about D and E. Even this other approach gives you these same two endpoints. And that makes you think that there's something special about those two measures, which is nice. Maybe there are all these other measures in between, but at least those two are somehow special.
And the theorem is for two qubits.
No, it's quite general. Quite general, yes. Isn't that nice? And now we get, that was it for part three. And I definitely have enough time for part four. It's just one transparency.
I have a question for part three.
Yeah, sure. Axiom 3 was what?
The additivity.
Additivity. Actually, I'm not sure. I bet Michael knows that. Not sure. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. That's a good question, because entanglement formation may not be additive, for example. Although entanglement cost is additive in that sense, certainly. And distillable entanglement certainly is additive in that sense.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of.
Right.
Some people
True. That's true.
Is you substitute for the additivity, multiplicativity.
Yep.
Then instead of using the expression, you use LP more. And there's been a lot of progress by looking at those and then taking the limit
for additivity. Oh, I see. Oh, that's interesting. Right. Yeah, the additivity, by the way, is what makes it kind of information theoretic.
Right.
Why these things look like entropies, why they have logarithms in them.
Right.
Yes, Michael.
Just to point out that the way you kind of view the axiom is usually phrased,
right,
it's kind of an implicit additivity in there, in the sense that if you take a large number of copies of the state.
It's true.
And then a large number of copies of something that's near to the state, then the way in which the difference in entanglement measure scales should be linear times something small, which depends on the states.
Right. Linear in the number of copies.
And if you do that, then you can actually throw out the additivity axiom and you still get results like this one that Horowitz used and other people.
Oh, okay, if you insist on that.
Oh,
okay, right. If you use that kind of continuity.
Right,
you can, I see, you can hide some additivity in there.
Well, as far as I'm aware, there's always some technical question about what you mean by continuous.
Right.
Yeah, you need to worry about the
additivity. Okay. I see. Right. Yes. Okay. Well, I'm going to move on to part four. Part four is this one transparency. Interesting facts about D and E. Just a few years ago, the Hordetskys discovered that there are states, mixed states, that are entangled. Okay. Alice and Bob can't create them over the phone. But you can't distill anything out of them, okay? So that's interesting. Those things are called bound entangled states now. And let me point out something interesting. When these states were discovered, it was not clear that they also had, they might have even had zero entanglement cost, which may sound a little paradoxical, but it wasn't known. And the reason is that even though we knew that it did cost Alice and Bob something to make it over the phone, they couldn't make it over the phone, they had to use some prior entanglement to create these states. The amount of prior entanglement per created pair could go to zero asymptotically as the number of pairs go to zero, in which case this thing would still be zero. So that wasn't known. But anyway, but these are called bound entangled states. The entanglement was there, but you couldn't get it out. Okay, and then just this year, Vidal and Sirac showed that they found an example of one of these bound entangled states for which they proved that the cost was greater than zero, so asymptotically. So that meant that there really is some irreversibility here. This is the first example of known irreversibility. So some people have started talking about a kind of thermodynamics of entanglement. It's an interesting subject. There are all sorts of analogies that come to mind about free energy, and people talk about free entanglement, bound entanglement. This was the first example of that, where it does definitely cost more than you can get out. You can get out nothing, but it costs something to make it. But this is an interesting thing. The Hordetskys also showed in 1998 that bound entanglement states can be useful, even though you can't distill any entanglement out of them. You can do this with them. You can take some other state. This is some other state, not the bound entangled state, that you can sort of distill. You can get closer to psi plus, but you can't. I mean psi minus, but you can't get there, and you can't even get close to it, even with vanishing probability. Okay, that is, there's some limit to how close you can get to this state. If you just have one copy, I'm talking about one copy of this pair in this state here. So that's just a fact that there are these states that have this property. So, and that have the property that if you add to that a whole bunch of bound entangled states, then you can get arbitrarily close to the singlet state, okay, with some probability. And then you could use it for teleportation, okay? So you might not be able to do any kind of teleportation with any kind of reasonable fidelity with this state, but but you can do it with this state when you have the bound entanglement added on. So that's a neat thing. So the bound entanglement, the entanglement hasn't completely disappeared. It's still there and can be brought out in that context. And here's an even stronger version of this. If it's true, it has been conjectured, and good, and a lot of evidence has been presented for this, evidence presented by Shor and others, that there are two different states that are both bound entangled states, okay, that you can't distill any pure entanglement out of this one or the other one. But if Alice and Bob have both, then they can get some entanglement out. What's known is that this is true and that this is true. Okay, it's not known that this is true, but it's, there's a lot of good numerical evidence suggesting it's true. Yes?
I'm sorry, I was completely lost in example. Why is that not a distillation scheme? Why are there four for that? Why are they not distilling?
Okay, yes, yes. No, this is distillation. That's distillation.
So then
and this is also, this is a funny kind of thing. This is just one copy. This is not asymptotic in this guy. You just have one copy, so it's different from what I described earlier.
In distillation schemes, what makes these bound entanglements? You can't say that nothing can be distilled from them. I didn't understand the distinction.
It means that if you have only that, so you have a zillion copies of these bound entangled states, you can't get anything out. You can't get any pure entanglement out of just those.
So this D function must be calculated without any kind of external.
That's correct. That's right. But if you add this one copy of this, then you can get one copy with some probability, maybe small, of that.
So the D applies only to some closed system.
That's true. That's true. The D of something, and that definitely has to be true here. The D of something means that all you have is lots of copies of this guy. Many, many copies of it, but it's always the same one. So that can be zero. No, you can't get any pure entanglement from this one or from this one, but from the two together, you can get something out. So this suggests that even when you have this bound entangled state, bound entanglement, the entanglement is somehow still there. That is, you didn't completely waste. It cost something to make this, but you haven't put that effort in vain. Okay, there's still something there that you can get out. Okay, and that is the end. Let me except just to point out a few things that I haven't mentioned, things I have left out. There's a whole interesting literature on what's called the relative entropy of entanglement, which is an upper bound on D. You can talk about multipartite entanglement. I've only talked about bipartite entanglement. You can talk about non-asymptotic. There at the end, there was one non-asymptotic. Michael Nielsen here is an expert on non-asymptotic conversions. And the dot, dot, there's a number of other topics. But that's it for now. Thanks very much.
About two
multipartite. Here's something that's interesting. Suppose you have three qubits, three two-state systems. Then we know that there are really two distinct kinds of entanglement here. You can have pairwise entanglement, okay, and that can be pairwise between these two or these two or these two, and you can have three-way entanglement. And the thing, and those two kinds are not interconvertible in the way that one might hope that they would be. So if one is going to talk about distillable entanglement for something like this, you have to say, well, what kind of entanglement are you trying to distill? So that you might have a distillable, in other words, distillable entanglement might be several numbers, not just one number.
So three-way entanglement.
That would be like up, 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 plus down, down, down.
Is that where you, if you perform a measurement on one qubit, mm-hmm. the other two are still entangled?
No. The three are entangled together, but if you perform a measurement on one of them, it depends on what measurement, I guess. Yeah, it depends on what measurement, right? But if you say, so here's an example of a three-way entanglement.
I said it'd be longer than that. Pairwise entanglement is where, if you perform a measurement on
yes, one, absolutely.
The other two would
that's,
be
that's true.
Any measurement
that's true.
And triplet could destroy the entanglement.
That's right. Triplet really is three-way, and it may not have any two-way at all. Right. Yes, yeah, Ivan.
So you talked a lot about what's known about bipartite systems and qubits.
Oh, well, a lot of what I've said was not qubits.
Okay, so what's, for example, do we know, for example, if I have bipartite systems, but they're finite dimensional.
Right.
Whether I can say for pure states, whether they're entangled,
yes,
things of that nature.
Oh, for pure states, it's just everything is known.
What about the multipart?
Oh, and let me add. Oh, let me just add this while I'm talking about this, because something I meant to say is for pure states, bipartite, the entanglement, no matter how big the dimension is of these particles, the entanglement is equal to the entropy of this particle, which is always equal to the entropy of this particle. And a way to think about that is the only way these guys can have entropy is by being entangled. Okay, they're in a pure state. So the only way this has entropy is by being entangled. This completely breaks down when you have mixed states, because the thing can have entropy of its, in its own right, without it doesn't have to come from entanglement. So that's why it's so much harder for mixed state. Now, suppose you have more parts. For pure states, it's even there, it's complicated, and the whole story is not known, because you have these different kinds of entanglement. There's no, I don't know of a formula. I don't know a formula. Is there a formula? Anyone know?
Is there a test for entanglement? Suppose I'm given a multi-part type.
You give a multiple, right.
And I want to know, is this an entangled state?
Is there any entanglement?
Any entanglement of any kind. So is it, right. It's a pure state, and I want to just know whether or not it's separable or not.
Whether or not it's separable. Let's see, there must be. Michael's... What's... Oh, yeah, entanglement witnesses. Right. Well, that's true. Right. You have to choose these witnesses properly.
Yeah.
So...
Barbara's results were in the bipartite case, but you can certainly do similar things in the multipartite case.
But there's nothing as simple as the first formula that showed, you know, if A, B is not equal to C.
Oh, gosh, no.
There's also some recent work by Dave Meyer and Nolan Wallach on polynomial invariance for quantifying multiparticle effect.
Right, polynomial invariance, right? Yes, so you can sort of, so these are things that are invariant under unitary transformations of the separate parts. So if you specify all of these numbers, then you sort of have the complete story of entanglement for these guys, because you don't think entanglement should change when you just rotate the individual subsystems.
Direct detection of quantum entanglement.
Oh, this paper, Direct Detection of Quantum Entanglement.
Maybe.
Oh, gosh.
That's what he was asking.
Yeah, that sounds very, very relevant. I don't have that paper on the top of my head, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. Yes?
Okay, maybe I just missed the point. Suppose you have a large system, or whatever, system of n spins 1/2.
Okay, yes.
Okay, the system is in some mixed state, which is described by some density metric rule.
Yes.
Now, you say that for this state, you can assign some number, which means that you calculate some trace or probably some operator. Now you get this number, you call it D. Suppose D is equal to, say, 0.3. What does it tell you? I don't understand what is usefulness of having this number.
Now,
you explain why it is good to have entanglement.
Now are you talking?
Explain why it is good to have some number.
Okay, you're talking about my D. Oh, yes. Let me...
What is the meaning of this number?
I'm glad you asked, because it has a very definite meaning in the case that I'm talking about here. Suppose you have 1,000 of these pairs,
okay,
in some mixed state, 1,000 copies of the same mixed state, and you find that mathematically, you just crunch it out, that D equals 0.3, okay? Then that means that by local operations, you can turn these 1,000 copies into 300 perfectly entangled singlets, okay? And no better, okay? They're actually asymptotically. I'm assuming that 1,000 equals infinity for this. And it tells you how many you can make. Once you have 300 of these pairs, you can use those to teleport 300 qubits from one place to the other. So it really tells you how useful this thing is for transmitting quantum states.
So one is good, zero is good.
One is great, zero is bad. And 0.3.
Many ways to assign number between zero and one.
Yes, but this is a way that actually has meaning. It really is how many good perfect pairs can you distill out, and which you can then use to transmit by teleportation quantum states. Yes?
Back in your early Alice Bond teleportation.
Yes.
You're teleporting the measured particle, not it prior to that measure, because you're only getting the property of it measured with respect to the
length. Oh, no. It's better than that. You're really teleporting the whole thing. And let me, I have this transparency prepared, actually, in case someone wanted to see it. No one has asked to, but I'll show it anyway. This is the algebra of teleportation, which I think will make it perfectly clear. So let me first of all define those four states. Remember, Alice distinguishes between among those four states of two particles that are in her possession.
Or by some combination.
It might be in it will be in some combination, but the measurement she makes is a measurement that asks the question, choose one of those four states. Okay? And here we'll just use this notation for these two as I've been using before, and let me introduce this notation for the other two. Okay? Okay. Here's the unknown state that's coming in that some other person, third person, Carol, hands to Alice at some point and asks her to teleport it to Bob. Okay? This is the entangled pair of Alice and Bob. Okay? So this is Alice, this is Bob. Alice and Bob. It's just I can just rewrite this thing mathematically this way, just multiply it out, okay? And then just decompose that in this way. Okay, this is just math, just algebra, to go from here to here, where these guys are these four states, okay? And now, so nothing's been done physically. I've just rewritten the state that Alice and Bob share now. Alice has two particles, Bob has one. And now Alice performs this measurement, this versus this versus this versus this, on her two particles. And then whatever outcome she gets, what Bob has is what's left over, is the corresponding Bob particle state. So that if, for example, Alice gets this outcome, okay, that's this one, okay, then Bob has this state. Okay, which is not the state that was to be teleported, that's this one. But it's very simply related to it, and Bob can fix it. So as soon as Bob finds out which of these four answers Alice got from her measurement, he knows what to do to fix the state and make it go back into this state.
Where does he get the information to fix it?
Alice tells him. Alice tells him which of the four outcomes she got. She calls him on the phone. Right, this is a phone kind of thing.
But that outcome doesn't tell her what the state of the original particle.
No one ever finds out the state of the original particle. Alice doesn't find out, Bob doesn't find out.
What information does she give in her phone call that would ask her to phone out?
I got outcome number three.
How does he know from that he needs to negate that question?
Okay, because he knows this. He doesn't know what alpha and beta are, neither does Alice, but they know the algebra. Okay, so when Alice says, I got outcome number three, he says, well, then I have this, and I want to get this. I don't know what alpha and beta are, but I know what transformation takes this to that. So no one ever finds out what the state was.
And there's no mechanism for this kind of
state. Yeah. See, it's fun to think about that, isn't it? Yeah. But I certainly wouldn't presume to lay out a mechanism. I don't think there's any mechanism. It's all there in the quantum mechanics. What words you attach to it is an interesting question, and I certainly don't have any particular insight into that. Yes?
We have two entangled pairs. They may teleport entangled state of two.
Oh, absolutely, you can do that. Suppose you have Alice and Bob share an entangled pair, and then Alice and Carol share an entangled pair.
No, Alice and Bob have two entangled.
Oh, okay, all right, okay.
They may teleport more complicated
states. They can teleport a four-dimensional state then. Right? They can teleport something that has four dimensions instead of just two dimensions. Right? And if they have three, they can teleport eight dimensions. They can teleport any state in an eight-dimensional vector space. Yes, so, right, exactly. Yes?
Sorry.
Okay.
You've been drawing analogies of, you know, indeed entropy, making an analogy throughout.
Well, entropy is all embodied in this, yes, right.
If you have a closed ideal system, is there proof is it fair to say that if you do everything in a clever way, that entropy doesn't say any about it, that E will equal B? Because it all requires, that's not good. Now, given your closed system, and you do everything clever, and you engineer and then distill.
So that you're saying that in the process of creating this mixed state, you don't completely throw away the information that you would have thrown away. So you don't. You have a mixed state if you look locally, but then over here, somewhere else in your big system, in your big isolated system, there is the information that you would have thrown away. Then you can certainly recreate what you started with, but then we wouldn't call it D. It wouldn't be distillation, because you really have the pure states all along. Right.
I think we should